wondering what he was doing standing naked in the hallway with an erection. Maybe he'd been masturbating? He didn't think so. He stumbled back to bed and fell asleep. On the porch, the Simonians confronted Jenkins, who said, "I ought to arrest every fucking one of you guys. You can't go driving around town kidnapping people, for Christ's sakes." "He cut the arms off Hamlet and the legs off Hake," said Levon Simonian, their spokesman. "We gonna cut off his pecker and make him eat it." "That's a worthwhile thought, but not here," Jenkins said. "It'd cause all kinds of trouble. You guys get back in your RV and get the fuck out of here. I don't want to see you back here again. If I do, I'll kick your ass." "You think you can take all of us?" the youngest of the Simonians asked. Jenkins did a quick survey. Except for the youngest one, they were all middle-aged and fat, though they showed signs of having done a few million bench presses, and said, "Yes." They spent a few seconds in a stare-down, and then Levon Simonian said, "We should complain to the police force in St. Paul that this man walks around free, while Hamlet has no arms, and Hake has no legs." "You do that," Jenkins said, "first thing tomorrow morning. Right now, let me tell you about Mickey's Diner." 5 minutes later, he had the RV on its way to Mickey's, and Jenkins called Virgil. "What?" "I ran them off. You want me to sit here some more?" "Peck saw me," Jenkins said. "No. Go home. Sleep." "Don't call me again," Virgil said. "You sound a little snappish." Click. "And very un-Virgil-like," Jenkins said to the dead phone. He went home. At 7:30 in the morning, Virgil was getting into a second round of REM sleep when the phone rang again, and he vaulted out of bed, grabbed it, and shouted, "What?" After a couple of seconds of silence on the other end, a man's voice said, "This is Rudd. I'm the highway patrol guy who helped you follow that Zhang Ferrari into Minneapolis." "What?" Confused now and quieter. "I thought I should call and tell you in case you hadn't heard. The Minneapolis cops just pulled old man Zhang's body out from behind a dumpster at a strip club." "What?" Rudd had gotten the news by monitoring his radio, and finally by a call to the Minneapolis cops because of his involvement with tracking the Ferrari. When he was told that Zhang was dead, he thought to call Virgil. "Thank you," Virgil said. "This is a big deal. This is the third murder in the tiger hunt." Frankie was awake now, and she groaned and said, "Bad night. I gotta go," Virgil said. "You okay? I feel like somebody hit me on the head with a phone book." He stood in the shower for 5 minutes, switching between hot and cold, shaved, got back in the shower, and dressed. Frankie had eased out of bed while he was cleaning up and gave him a 30-ounce Yeti Rambler container of coffee to take with him. 45 minutes after Rudd's call, he was headed back north to the cities. He'd had maybe 4 hours of sleep after a whole series of sleep-deprived nights, and was feeling it. The coffee helped. On the way north, he called the Minneapolis cops and talked to a homicide detective named Anderson Huber. "A garbage guy found him about 5 o'clock this morning when they were moving a dumpster. Missing his wallet, a 5-carat diamond pinky ring, and a watch that his kid says is worth $100,000, though that's a little hard to believe. He said it was a Filipino something or other. My partner wrote it down if you're interested. Anyway, he'd been dead for several hours, but a good time of death might be hard to come up with because his body was superheated." "How's that?" Virgil asked. "He was behind the strip club, that's the Swedish bikini bar, and they got a stove vent comes out of the wall right above the dumpster. Warm enough that you get bums sleeping back there in the winter. Last night might have been 150 degrees back there, so he was superheated. On the upside, he smells like a whole lot of expensive cheeseburgers." "Shot?" "Nope. Strangled. Rope was still around his neck. Nylon rope, pretty small diameter. That parachute cord stuff, you can get it anywhere," Huber said. "I wouldn't be surprised if the killer has rope creases or bruises on his hands because this thing really got dragged on." "What does his son say?" Virgil asked. "We're talking to him now. He's pretty screwed up. He tried to file a missing persons report last night. He called 911 a couple of times, but, you know, the old man was an adult. Nothing wrong with him, not mentally ill or incapacitated, and the son told the 911 operator that his old man sometimes liked to go out and look at girls. We thought maybe he'd found a hooker and was getting his ashes hauled. You look at the kid's hands? Yeah, nothing there. I tell you what, Virgil, it's possible, I guess, that the kid killed him because, as I understand it, the Zhang guy's got a lot of money and the kid stands to inherit. But when he freaked, it's hard to believe that he was faking it. Me and my partner went to tell him. We knew about him because of the 911 calls. And if he was faking, he ought to get an Academy Award. We had to sit him down to keep him from falling down. And he was bawling like a little girl. Not fake bawling, real bawling. Then when we took him to identify the body, he started all over again. All right. I'm going to tell you who did it, or at least who knows who did it. I'd appreciate that. Virgil gave Huber everything he had on the Tiger case and told him that he believed Peck was involved in at least two murders, and now quite possibly a third. I believe if he didn't do it, he knows who did. He does know the kid. I'll go ring his doorbell, Huber said. Before you do that, ask the kid if he thinks Peck was involved in the murder. Sneak up on him and then whack him with it. See what his face says. Where are you at right now? Highway 169 south of the cities. I'll be up there about 9:30, Virgil said. How about we keep him here until then and you whack him? Since you've got the background, you might be able to riff on something we don't even know about. Happy to. I'll see you then, Virgil said. Traffic was bad going into town, but Virgil found a police-reserved parking spot next to City Hall and put out his BCA dashboard sign, then hustled into what he believed might be one of the ugliest City Halls in the country. He found Huber, who took him down to the office of a homicide lieutenant named Kevin Hauser, where Zhang Xiaomin was sitting in a visitor's chair, typing on a laptop, while the lieutenant was talking on his phone. Zhang's face looked raw, Virgil saw, as though he'd been weeping all night, and his eyes were bloodshot. He looked up when he saw Virgil, and his eyes shifted. Virgil thought, okay, he knows who I am. Hauser got off the phone and crooked a finger at them and said, Virgil, how you doing? Could be worse, Virgil said. Then, wait, let me think about that. You haven't found the tigers. Not yet, Virgil said. Zhang was sneaking peeks at him. I'm hoping Mr. Zhang can help us with that. He's good friends with our leading suspect, who we think might also have murdered his father and a couple of other people. What about that, Mr. Zhang? Zhang pretended to be startled, but he wasn't, and the three cops exchanged a quick flicker of glances. Zhang said, What are you talking about? Who are you? You know who I am, Virgil said. We met in the Cub supermarket, but I didn't know it at the time. Who tipped you off? Was Peck out in the parking lot? Zhang's head seemed to sink an inch or two into his chest, and he said, I don't know what this officer is talking about. I know this Peck man, but I only get medicine from my father. Tiger medicine? Virgil asked. Was your old man the West Coast distributor? Zhang's head seemed to sink an inch farther into his chest. I don't know their business. My father didn't tell me. I only bought small medicine from Dr. Peck for my father. Virgil said, You're full of shit, Zhang. I know you're involved, and I'm going to put you in prison for it. The big question now is, did you help kill your father? Zhang's head came up and he shouted, I did not kill my father. I did not. You go away. Go away. Virgil jerked his head at Hauser and Huber to get them out in the hall, and Huber said in a low voice, Okay, I see him now. He's involved. Virgil said, Do me a favor. Get your crime scene guys to take a look at his dirty clothes and the driver's seat in his car. If they pick up a single tiger hair. We can do that, Hauser said. I agree with Huber. He knows something that he's not telling us. I didn't see that in him until now. Since we talked to you on the phone, we took a look at old man Zhang online, and there's an article in Forbes that said that he got out of China with more than $100 million. and another small item from a Chinese-American society rag from L.A. that says he's about to get married again. His kid might think that money is going away. Hauser asked Virgil to make a formal statement about his observations of Zhang. They could already go through the father's belongings at the hotel because there wasn't any question of a crime in his case, and because he'd ridden in a car under suspicious circumstances, they could also look at the car. What they needed from Virgil was anything that would allow them to look at the son's possessions. Virgil didn't have much, but with the right judge, they might get a warrant. Virgil was making the statement when Katrin Mattson called. "I think I found Blankenship. You still in bed?" "No, I'm up at the Minneapolis PD," Virgil said. "Great. He's at a biker friend's house in Falcon Heights. I'm on my way up there." "What are you doing up so early?" Virgil told her about the murder of Zhang, and she whistled. "Whew, that's three. The Tigers don't look so important anymore. You've got to get this guy off the street." "Yeah, I do." "Did you hear about the fire?" Virgil asked. "What fire?" He told her about the fire and the question of who might be behind it. "We'll get Blankenship and squeeze his turnip-like head," Mattson said. "I got his location from his brother, who hates him. His brother got it from their mom, who also apparently hates him." "How far out are you?"
"I went through Jordan a few minutes ago," Mattson said.
"What's that, 45 minutes?
"I'll meet you at the office in 45 minutes. If this guy's with a biker friend, maybe I ought to get Shrake to back us up."
"I'll buy that." Virgil called up John Duncan, told him about the murder of Zhang and about the pending arrest of Blankenship.
"I need Shrake if I can get him."
"I saw him here a few minutes ago," Duncan said. "If you had to guess, how long before you wrap the Tiger thing?"
"Tomorrow? The Minneapolis cops are going to squeeze Zhang the younger, and I doubt that he'll hold out. Not completely hold out, anyway. I wouldn't be surprised if he gives up Peck. I think Zhang will know about the Tigers."
"Good. That's good," Duncan said. "Man, three dead. This really turned into something. Virgil, remember what I said about you and Blankenship? You can go, but let the other guys carry the load. We don't need him walking around loose, but we don't need him shoving a lawyer down our throat, claiming that you violated his civil rights or some shit like that. Don't touch him."
"I won't even take my gun with me."
"I wasn't worried about you shooting him, Virgil. You couldn't hit the side of a barn from the inside."
"Hey!"
"I was worried about you breaking his face." "Oh yeah, I was supposed to remind you. You're up to qualify again. Get your pistol and stop by the range as soon as you're done with this Tiger thing. So, day after tomorrow? At the range?"
29. Shrake had called Jenkins, who had been getting up anyway, so both the BCA thugs met Virgil and Mattson in John Duncan's office at BCA headquarters. Duncan himself was at a meeting to discuss security at the state fairgrounds, trying to figure out what might blow up, if anything might. The Secret Service wanted the state to hire septic system inspectors to put cameras down all the water lines, but the state was pleading poverty. "If I was involved in that particular disaster, I might go looking for a security guard job at the Mall of America," Shrake said. Jenkins asked Mattson, "Blankenship's brother hates him? What'd he do to his brother?" Both Brad Blankenship and his brother George were interested in the same woman, one Ellen Fry of Henderson, Minnesota. "I talked to her yesterday. She's a hot little number, but not entirely what you'd call a one-man woman," Mattson said. Shrake said, "Ah, the brothers became competitive." "If it was only that, there might not have been any trouble," Mattson said. "Ellen Fry sees that Brad is not such a good risk, and so she slides on over to George. One thing leads to another, she gets pregnant, and George does the right thing and marries her. They're married for 2 days when a DVD arrives in the mail from Brad. Seems that she and Brad had done a little experimentation on camera. Even worse, it wasn't a selfie porno. There was a cameraman in the room. George is an unhappy man right now."
"It's exactly this kind of thing that can create stress in a family tree," Jenkins said.
Virgil raised a finger.
I'm as interested in porno gossip as the next guy, but, any hint that Blankenship might carry a gun? You know anything about his biker friend? I'd hate to run into some cop-hating Nazi without seeing it coming. They all looked at Mattson, who said, I ran the biker, name is Dougie Howe, and he's been picked up a few times on dope charges, small amounts of weed and small amounts of heroin, and twice for DUI, plus a boatload of speeding tickets. That's about it. No violence on the record. He runs a home-based motorcycle customizing business called Harley Heaven. Blankenship is the guy we have to worry about. He's flashed guns a few times, but never pulled a trigger, as far as we know. Shrake asked, Armor up? Virgil said, It's really hot. I don't think we'll need it, Mattson said. A Sibley County deputy told me Blankenship's a puncher, not a shooter. Jenkins said, Yeah, fuck it. Who's driving? They went in two cars, Virgil's Forerunner and Shrake's truck. Mattson rode with Virgil and said, Alvarez is out of the hospital. She looked worse going in, but wasn't actually as bad as Frankie. Frankie's going to be hurting for a while, Virgil said. She can't find a comfortable way to sleep. I know, but don't take it out on Blankenship. You really do have to be a little careful here. I already got the lecture from John, Virgil said. I've also got the TV people hanging on me about the Tiger thing. They haven't figured out that Zhang is connected, but they will. I got to get back on that, but I want to do this one too. I want to be there when you get him. After a moment, Mattson said, You know, the only reason Blankenship is getting any attention at all is because you're a BCA agent, and the whole question of why Frankie was beaten up. We know the answer to that, and it doesn't have anything to do with you or Frankie. They got the wrong woman. Ordinarily, an assault, even a bad one, isn't going to pull in four BCA agents. I know, but when it's all said and done, Frankie's still hurt. And then there's the firebomb last night. Yeah, the firebomb. You agree that it's possible that the firebomb could have come from the Tiger job, if it was aimed at you at all. Possible. I want to see what Blankenship has to say about that. I want to see his face. Dougie Howe lived in a neighborhood of ranch-style houses a few blocks from the University of Minnesota's golf course, where Virgil had whiled away some time as a bad golfer. He'd always preferred team sports to solo games like golf or archery. Howe's house was visible from two blocks away. It didn't exactly have a blue-tick coonhound lolling in the shade of a short-block Chevy engine that hung from a sassafras tree in the front yard, but it was over in that direction, with bits and pieces of motorcycles lining the driveway and scattered around the front yard. A bumper sticker on the side of the mailbox said, Forget the dog. Beware of owner. A red Ford pickup was parked at the curb in front of the house next to Howe's, and Mattson said to Virgil, That's Blankenship's truck. He's here. Good, Virgil said. We can tie it up here. Shrake called on Virgil's cell, which Virgil switched over to the speaker. Who's gonna knock? Mattson said, You and me, Shrake. I want Jenkins on the side of the house to the left, because he's the sprinter among us, and Virgil down the side of the house to the right. Everybody good with that? Everybody was good with it. Shrake and Mattson walked up to the house. The front door was open, although there was a screen door in front of it. Mattson pushed the doorbell, which didn't work, so she knocked on the aluminum screen door, and a man yelled, Come on in, whoever it is. I'm in the kitchen. Virgil got a phone call, a BCA number. He rejected it for the time being. Out front, Mattson and Shrake looked at each other, and Mattson said, Sure. Shrake pulled his pistol and held it by his leg, and they both walked back to the kitchen where Howe was sitting at a counter with a little girl, both of them eating bowls of cereal. Howe was a fat man, bald, with a blonde beard that had been twisted into a number of pigtails. He wore rimless glasses, a t-shirt, and cargo shorts. He asked, Who are you? We're with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Mattson said. Where's Brad? Howe cocked his head back and asked, Cops? He didn't say anything about the cops looking for him. Well, we are, Shrake said. Howe shrugged and shouted, Hey, Brad, There's some cops here looking for you.
2 seconds later, a door banged open in the back of the place, and Howe said,
Shit, he ran out the back patio.
Shrake ran toward the sound of the door, and Mattson ran back out the front door and yelled, He's running! He's running! Virgil had some problems on his side of the house. He'd been standing near the back corner of Howe's house when a woman screamed from the house next door.
Dan! Dan, there's a man! There's a man! There's a man looking in the bedroom window!
Virgil turned that way, and a man shouted out the window,
What the fuck?
Virgil said, as quietly as he could and still be audible, I'm a cop, and I'm not looking in your window. The man looked at Virgil's long blonde hair, the band t-shirt, and the cowboy boots and said,
Bullshit, you're a cop.
The woman, somewhere inside but not visible, shouted,
Get your gun, Dan.
At that moment, from the front of the house, Mattson screamed,
He's running! He's running!
Virgil turned to Howe's backyard and saw Blankenship bolt across the yard, stepping through ankle-deep water in a child's plastic swimming pool as he went. There was a chain-link fence across the back of Howe's lot, and he vaulted the waist-high fence with Jenkins, and then Shrake, behind him. Virgil followed as far as the fence, then thought to turn back to the house in case Howe might be a threat. But a barefoot Howe had come out on the patio with the little girl. He said to Virgil,
He didn't say nothing about cops looking for him.
How long has he been here? Virgil asked.
Since yesterday.
A man ran around the corner of the house. He was carrying a huge, shiny revolver, saw Virgil, pointed the pistol generally in Virgil's direction, and hollered,
Hold it!
Howe shouted,
What the fuck are you doing, Dan? These are cops!
The man hesitated, then said,
Oh,
and pointed the gun at the ground. Virgil said, There are three other cops here. If they see that gun, they could kill you. A woman jogged around the corner of the house in a bathrobe. She stopped behind Dan, pointed at Virgil, and said, That's him, Dan.
Howe said, They're cops, Jane. They're going to kill you guys if they see that fucking gun.
Dan said to the woman, We better get back inside. The little girl said to Virgil,
My dad said fucking.
That happens sometimes, honey, Virgil said. He heard Jenkins shouting something from what seemed to be down the block, but more toward the front yard. Virgil said, I better get out there. He ran down the side of the house, and in the front yard he saw Blankenship sprinting toward his truck, with Jenkins 20 yards behind. Shrake was out of sight somewhere, but Mattson was standing near the back end of Blankenship's truck, raking leaves. The rake had the fan-type thin, wide blades made for lawn care, rather than the heavy tangs of a garden rake. It worked well enough, though, especially when Blankenship tried to run past her, and she lifted the rake and swatted him in the face. He went down on his back, and Jenkins was on top of him before he got reorganized, flipped him over, and snapped on the cuffs. Shrake came puffing up a minute later as Jenkins and Mattson were putting Blankenship in the back of Virgil's truck. Blankenship was bleeding from 3 fan-shaped cuts on his face.
What happened to him? Shrake asked.
Catrin hit him in the face with the rake, Virgil said, nodding to the rake that was now lying on the neighboring lawn.
I'm liking this chick better all the time, Shrake said.
He looked down at his tan pants, which had 2-foot-long grass stains on the legs.
I fell or I would have been here for it. God damn it, I miss all the fun stuff.
Blankenship was cuffed to the ring welded to the floor in the back of Virgil's truck. He said, I'm going to sue you motherfuckers.
Shut up, Virgil said as he got in the truck, or I'll tell all your friends in Mankato that you got your ass kicked by a woman.
She ambushed me, Blankenship said.
I'd lie about it, Virgil said. Now shut up.
I want a lawyer.
Yeah. Shut up. My face is all cut up. I'm bleeding, Blankenship said.
Throw a little dirt on it, Virgil said. Mattson added, and shut up.
They went by the BCA, and Mattson picked up her car and followed Virgil over to the Ramsey County Jail, where she took Blankenship inside and told Virgil, Go find the Tigers.
Yeah.
Catrin, thanks. I appreciate what you've done. He couldn't decide whether to shake Mattson's hand or hug her, but didn't do either. When she simply nodded, stepped back, and said, Nice working with you, Virgil. Let's do it again. 30. Virgil left the jail, and as he headed out of the parking lot, checked his phone. Two missed calls from the same personal number, and he thought it might belong to Sandy, the BCA researcher. He was right.
"Virgil," she said. She sounded breathless. "Where have you been?"
"Arresting a guy, nothing to do with the Tigers. What happened?"
"You know I was tracking that phone that belonged to Hamlet Simonian? Well, I figured it out."
"Where is it?"
"It was in Oakland, California, at a FedEx place. Whoever sent it shipped it ground, so we'd think somebody was driving it across country," Sandy said.
"Ah, hell. Is it still there?"
"No, it's in a truck heading south toward Los Angeles. It should be there in a couple of hours. But here's the thing. It's an iPhone, and iPhones have their location services on by default. That means if we get the phone, and if it's not password protected, and he hasn't turned off the location services, we can open up the privacy section and see everywhere the phone's been. Like, if he went to where the Tigers were, we would probably get an exact address."
"We need that. Right now.
You think the phone is headed toward L.A.?"
"Yes, probably in a semi-truck, which would be a huge load of packages, but I talked to FedEx, and everything on the truck will be sorted for local delivery, which means we can probably narrow it down to one delivery truck. From there, we ought to be able to find it."
"Do you have a date this evening?" Virgil asked.
"What?"
"If I get John to put you on a plane, are you up for a quick trip to L.A.?"
"Well, sure, but I gotta tell you, it could be password protected, and Apple doesn't help you crack those, even if you're a cop."
"I know all about Apple, and I also know that when we searched Hamlet Simonian's room, we found a little book that seems to be full of passwords."
"Pack your party panties and get out to the airport. You're going," Virgil said. "I'll call John right now and get him to authorize a ticket. And a hotel with a pool."
"Oh, my God. All right. I'll be on my phone."
Virgil called Duncan, who said he'd fix it, and put Sandy on the first flight into LAX. If Sandy could find out where Hamlet Simonian had been, Virgil thought. And then he thought, wait a minute, we've got phones closer than L.A. He called Minneapolis Homicide, got Hauser on the phone.
"Does Zhang have an iPhone?"
"Yeah, he's also got a lawyer who's standing right behind him," Hauser said. "And we really don't have enough to hold him.
Damn it.
Ask him anyway. Ask him if he'll let you look in his iPhone. Don't specify what you're looking for, but you might hint you want to look at his messages. Then you go to the privacy settings, see if the location services are turned on, and if they are, look at the phone's history and tell me where it's been the last few days."
"I can ask, but I'll tell you, he's got Horace Turner here. You know him, the attorney? No? Well, Horace is an asshole of Jovian dimensions. The chances of him letting me look are slim and none. And Slim is out of town."
"Not just out of town, he's in fucking Transnistria," Hauser said. "But I'll try."
Virgil headed over to the BCA building and was nearly there when Hauser called back.
"Turner told me where I could stick my request, and it's not a place you'd want to visit. I have one fact that you'll find interesting, and a thought."
"I'll take both," Virgil said. "What's the fact?"
"Found a couple of hairs on the old man's shoes. Crime scene isn't promising anything, but they could well be from a tiger. Definitely animal hair, or fur, or whatever it is, and the right color for a tiger."
"Excellent. That's great.
What's the thought?" "If his old man was in on this, if he was killed by this Peck guy, well, we have the old man's phone. We don't need anybody's permission to look at that, since he's, like, dead."
"Despite what people say, you are a man of average intelligence," Virgil said. "I'm on my way."
Zhang Sr.'s phone was sitting on Hauser's desk when Virgil arrived back at Minneapolis Homicide. It had been processed by the crime scene people and sent to the evidence room, where Hauser had collected it. He dumped it out of a plastic bag, and they stood around and looked at it.
"Not an iPhone," Hauser said. "What the hell is a jazz pod?"
"There's some Chinese writing on it," Virgil observed.
"Must be a Chinese brand," Hauser said.
"Turn it on."
Virgil did, and they found that the phone's top language was English, and that it was fingerprint protected.
Hauser said. God damn it. So close. Virgil, thinking of the prints they'd taken from Hamlet Simonian, said, Well, we've got his fingers. Before going to the medical examiner's office, where Zhang's body was being held, Virgil and Hauser went back to the homicide office, where a cop was being harangued by Horace Turner, the younger Zhang's attorney.
We're already deep into the lawsuit. You've got no reason to hold my client.
Turner spotted Hauser and said, It's about time. This has gone beyond any reasonable hold and into physical abuse. Hauser looked at the other homicide cop and demanded, Have you been beating up Mr. Zhang? The other cop yawned and said through the yawn,
Only with my dry wit.
Hauser said to Turner, Does dry wit fall under the Civil Rights Act?
Let my person go, Turner said. And, for you cops, that's what we call a play on words.
Anyway, let him go, now. I'm instructing him not to say another word to you, not under these conditions. Virgil said to Turner, I think he choked his father to death for the inheritance. I think he was involved in the theft of the tigers. I think he's involved with at least a triple murder and maybe four murders.
No,
Zhang said. Virgil said, I'm not talking to you.
Show me a single thing, and there's a slim possibility that I won't sue you for abusing my client, Turner said.
His father's shoes had tiger hair on them.
That's a single thing.
This guy, Virgil pointed at Zhang, drove his father everywhere. His father didn't even have a car here. They took Junior's Ferrari when they wanted to go somewhere.
He took Ubers,
Zhang blurted.
Shut up, Turner said to Zhang.
Virgil said, Really? Ubers? I bet there's a record of that. Thanks, that helps. You mind if we look at your shoes?
If you've got a warrant, Turner said.
Hauser said, Why don't we keep Mr. Zhang sitting here for a while longer while we go get a warrant then?
I had nothing to do with...
Shut up, Turner said. Not another word. And to Hauser, Get your warrant, if you think you can. They left Turner, still complaining, and Zhang, now sourly silent, sitting in the homicide office. Virgil and Hauser went off to the medical examiner's office, and another cop went to apply for a warrant, and a fourth one sat with Zhang to make sure he didn't rub the soles of his shoes too hard on the carpet. The Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office had the same shoebox ambience as the Ramsey County Medical Examiner's Office, but instead of being simply plain, it was aggressively beige. An investigator pulled Zhang Sr.'s nude body, and Virgil looked away as the experts figured out how best to get a fingerprint. One of the examiner's employees, apparently an expert on cell phones, said,
There's no way to know which finger he used until we try them.
Try his right hand first, said the investigator, a tall, thin man with a hipster's goatee.
Based on...
The fact that 90% of the people in the world are right-handed, the investigator said. Try his right index finger first. They hit it on the first try, and the phone opened up. Virgil said, I'll take it out in the waiting area. But let Mr. Zhang hang on here in case we need the finger again.
You could take the finger with you, the investigator said.
Just kidding.
A little medical examiner humor there.
Zhang parts ain't going anywhere.
Virgil and Hauser went out to the waiting area, where it smelled less funny, and Virgil, who'd rehearsed on his own phone, poked his way through the menus of the jazz pod to the location history, and the history opened up. Most of the locations shown on the phone were in downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul, but one was in Washington County, east of St. Paul and adjoining the St. Croix River in Wisconsin. The problem was, all the locations were much more general than they were on iPhones. Instead of addresses, they got areas. For Washington County, they got a location circle that Virgil figured was 10 miles across. From previous such calculations during fugitive searches, Virgil knew that a circle 10 miles across would cover almost 80 square miles, and in this case, a nice chunk of suburbs and probably a few thousand homes.
That help? Hauser asked.
It does. Some,
Virgil said. We tracked the kid and his old man out that way, but they got onto us and turned around. We never did find out where they were going. The medical examiner's investigator had an iPad and a Wi-Fi connection, and they called up a mapping program's satellite photos and compared it to the phone location. That part of Washington County had dozens of small lakes and ponds, most of them isolated from the road system, and many with houses around them. That's a rat's nest of streets out there, twisted around all those lakes. You need a better location, Hauser said. You can't just go out there and drive around. Yeah, I maybe got a better location coming. In the meantime, talk to Zhang about his old man's travels through the countryside out there. Maybe crank up the pressure a little. As Virgil left the medical examiner's office, Sandy called from a plane that was on the runway at Minneapolis-St. Paul International. Got here by the skin of my teeth. John had to shout at Delta Airlines to get them to hold the plane for 5 minutes. Everybody's looking at me. They think I'm a movie star or something. I can see that, Virgil said. You should. Anyway, they're telling me to turn off my phone. I'll be in L.A. in 4 hours. Call me, Virgil said. Hey, where's the FedEx truck? Going into San Bernardino, last time I could look. Gotta go, or they'll throw me off the plane. The pressure to find the killer, and the Tigers, had grown intense, especially with Channel 3 now running a clock on the number of hours and minutes the animals had been missing. Virgil considered the possibilities and went to lunch. While he was working his way through an egg salad sandwich at the Parrot Cafe, he called around to see if he could find a human being at Uber. He eventually found one, who passed him up through several levels of management to a guy who said he couldn't call every Uber driver in the Twin Cities. He said there were thousands of them, though Virgil thought he might be exaggerating. I can get a mass emailing to them, but I can't guarantee that they'll read it, the Uber guy said. Tell me again exactly what you're looking for. Virgil described the two Zhangs and suggested that they may have been taken to Washington County the previous day from downtown Minneapolis. He gave the Uber guy his phone number and authorized him to give it to anyone who called back with information.
I'll do all that, but I wouldn't hold your breath, the Uber guy said.
Before he rang off, Virgil asked, Has anyone ever asked you if you're like an Uber manager? You know, like an Obersturmbannführer in Nazi Germany?
Yeah, people ask me that all the time, because they think it's funny. I tell them that, for one thing, in Germany it was spelled with an O, not a U, and for another thing, shut the fuck up.
Thanks, Virgil said. You've been really helpful.
Really?
A television in the corner of the cafe began running a midday news program, and the first thing shown were the faces of two tigers, and an all-caps caption that said, Dead? Virgil didn't need to have the sound turned up to know what was being said. He finished the egg salad sandwich and tried to figure out what to do next. 31. Peck was at a Walgreens off I-94, pushing a Xanax prescription across the counter, hoping it wouldn't bounce. The clerk looked at it, typed into a computer for a while, then asked, Do you want to pick these up later or wait?
How long if I wait?
15 or 20 minutes, the clerk said. The clerk seemed to be looking at him oddly, but Peck couldn't think why.
I'll wait, he said.
Drug secure again, he wandered off to the magazine rack, popped the last Xanax in his pill tube, and started paging through People. The magazine confused him. Who were all these celebrities? A few of the names were vaguely familiar, but most were not. One prominently displayed woman seemed to have an enormous ass and was famous for it. This was an ass that should have been on a balloon in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. Yet, as awkward and obscure as they were, all these people seemed to have media skills, either smiling directly into the camera lens or hiding bruised eye sockets behind dark glasses, or showing off their asses. These people, both the smiling ones and the bruised ones, needed to take more Xanax, he thought. He noticed that his left foot was tapping frenetically on the floor and stopped it. He got down another, cheaper celebrity magazine and was sucked into an apparently imaginary story about Jen. Jen's last name was never mentioned, and he had no idea who she was, although he thought he might have remembered her from some TV show a long time ago. That was confirmed when he got to the last paragraph of the story. The show was Friends, and it had ended 11 years earlier. 11 years. Peck would give everything to have had those 11 years back. For one thing, he wouldn't have messed around with those women in Indianapolis. If he'd gotten a regular doctor job, he'd be driving the big bucks now, fixing everything from Arskog syndrome to Zika virus. Mostly with Xanax. Done with the magazines, he started pacing the aisles, trying not to look impatient or worried, trying to look cool. He went by a cosmetic counter and caught an image of himself in a mirror. Even with the calming drug flowing around his brain, he knew why he'd gotten the odd look from the clerk. He was wearing a green golf shirt, but it was on backward, the collar up so it looked like a turtleneck. He wandered some more, purposefully now, until he saw a sign for the restrooms. There was only one, a unisex, but it was open. He went inside, locked the door, turned the shirt around, splashed some water on his face, checked his fly, smiled at himself, and went back out. 5 minutes later, he got his new tube of Xanax with no further comment or looks from the pharmacy clerk, and he went out to the parking lot and spent 15 minutes searching for his car. He eventually remembered that it had a remote panic alarm on the key fob, and he set it off, found the car, and crawled into the driver's seat, where he went to sleep, still clutching the paper sack that contained the new tube of pills. He woke sometime later with a woman rapping on the partially rolled-down driver's side window. He looked at her, and she stepped back and asked, "Are you okay?" "A little sleepy," he said. His mouth tasted like chicken shit smelled. "I'm fine." She went away, and he muttered after her, "Mind your own business, you old bitch." He smacked his lips, realized the temperature inside the car was near the boiling point. Would have killed a dog, he thought, and he started the car, put the AC on high, and wheeled out of the parking lot. The sun was much lower in the sky than it had been when he went into the Walgreens. How long had he been asleep? He looked at his watch and was surprised to see a mole on his wrist, but no watch. Must have forgotten to put it on. And where was he going? He had some other mission besides the pills. He sat at the stop sign and had to think a moment. He knew it was close by, and so it must... Ah! Walmart. He needed a meat grinder. Hake Simonian had not yet picked one up at the time of his unfortunate accident. He drove over to Walmart, a trip of 5 minutes or so, and when he got there, sat in the parking lot, trying to remember why he was there. Remembering was tough. He tried running through the alphabet, thinking of things he might need starting with an A, then a B. He'd gone all the way through to Z and was still sitting stupefied in his car when he remembered. Meat grinder. Before getting out of the truck, he automatically touched his pocket, checking to make sure he had his medication. He could feel it on his leg. He pulled the amber-colored tube out and almost panicked when he found it was empty. But he distinctly remembered Walgreens and looked at the passenger seat where he saw the white paper bag with the new prescription. A surge of relief. Drug secure again. But the old tube, the date on the tube was 2 days earlier. Could that be right? He took out his cell phone and checked the date, and it was right. He'd taken 30 Xanax tabs in 2.5 days? Jesus, he might have a problem here. Had to slow down with that shit. Maybe 3 a day. Okay, maybe 4. No more than 4. And only on bad days. He went into Walmart, functioning better now, found a hand-operated meat grinder. As he was walking down the aisle toward the checkout counters, A woman talking on a cell phone, accompanied by a clutch of children who appeared to be about 7, 6, 5, 4, and 3 years of age, was approaching with an overloaded shopping cart. He tried to dodge, but she crashed the cart into his legs, looked up, and said, "Hey, watch where you're going, asshole." As she walked away, he heard her say, "Some weirdo walked right into my cart." The Xanax worked to keep his temper under control. He put it all down to a Walmart moment, and Peck continued to the checkout. He paid cash for the meat grinder, went back to the car, drove out to I-94, and turned east. He was 10 miles from the farm with a stack of tiger jerky to grind up and another cat to kill. He really didn't want to do it anymore. The whole thing had spun out of control. But he needed the money. It had to be done, and he had to do it by himself. Nobody to help old Peck now. A tear gathered in his left eye, and he wiped it away. Nobody to help old Peck. 5 miles down I-94, Peck passed a Minnesota Highway Patrol car sitting in the median, running a speed trap. He reflexively tapped the brake and looked at his speedometer, found that he was only going 50 miles an hour. He hadn't noticed that all the other cars were passing him, but they were. He sped up a bit, the patrolman looking at him as he went past. He kept an eye on his rearview mirror, but the patrolman never moved. The sight of the cop made him nervous, and when he got to the farm, he drove his car around behind the barn where it couldn't be seen from the road. In the barn, the cat stood up and hissed at him. She really hated him, he knew, and he found that amusing. He picked up the rifle, carried it close to the cage, and the cat pressed against the wire mesh. He aimed the rifle at her eyes. "Who's the big dog now?" he asked her. He pulled the trigger. Nothing happened. He worked the bolt and looked down into the chamber. Nothing there and nothing in the magazine. Fuck it. The temperature inside the barn must have been 130, he thought. One of the dryers was still running, and he walked over and turned it off, and then opened the door, which he propped open with a rock. The incoming air felt cool on his skin compared to that inside the barn, but he knew the outside temperatures must still be in the 90s. After touching 100 earlier in the day. He went back to the dryer, opened the door, and looked inside. The last of the tiger meat was more than crispy. It looked like bacon that had been hard-fried for 10 minutes too many. He left the door open to cool the meat and went to the work table, where he'd piled up 3 stacks of dried meat, each a foot high. He took the grinder out of its box, used the screw clamps on the bottom to clamp it to the work table, and started grinding. After a while, the silence got to him, and he turned on Hake Simonian's radio, which Simonian had tuned to the public radio station, and listened to All Things Considered. Last thing up was a commentary on the missing tigers, with an interview with a state cop named John something. "I can tell you that we're picking up more and more material, more and more evidence to work with, and we're going to solve this. I was talking to our lead investigator this morning, and he thinks we'll have a break of some kind today or tomorrow. We're keeping our fingers crossed. We hope the tigers haven't been hurt, but we have to live with the possibility that they have been. I don't want to upset anyone, but that's the reality of the matter." The interviewer said, "We've seen an intimidating list of crimes that the thieves could be charged with. Do you really think that the perpetrators could be charged with anything like what we've seen? 15 or 20 separate crimes, possibly even including murder?" "From what we know now," the cop said, "we believe there have been at least 2 murders committed in the course of this crime. We've got the bodies of 2 brothers who we know were involved. Persons involved in this crime now fall under the felony murder statute, which means that they didn't have to pull a trigger or even know about the murders if they were involved in the initial crime. When we catch them, they're going to prison. 30 years in Minnesota, no parole. There is, of course, the matter of prosecutorial discretion. If somebody involved were to come forward to help us clear this matter up, a prosecutor could well decide to recommend leniency. That would have to happen soon, because I believe we're going to solve this crime on our own, in the next day or so, and start rounding up the perpetrators." Peck changed to a classic rock station and continued grinding. When he was done, he had 50 or 60 pounds of rough-ground dry meat, which he packed into 5 plastic buckets from Home Depot. The meat would eventually be poured into plastic tubes the size of his pill containers and sold for anything up to $25. He had, he thought, at least $50,000 worth of meat right there, and he hadn't even gotten to the good stuff yet. The bones would have to be broken up with a hammer before they could be ground. Hake Simonian had bought an anvil at an antique shop for that purpose, along with a heavy ball-peen hammer. Peck was too tired for that, maybe dehydrated from the heat. He needed a quart of cold water and an icy margarita and a nap. Xanax, for sure. He picked up the rifle and the box of cartridges and started for the door. Katya hissed again, and he turned and said, "When I come back, I'm gonna blow your brains out, kitty cat. Right after I take my nap. Look forward to it."
32. Virgil spent part of the afternoon making phone calls, staying in touch with Minneapolis Homicide about the younger Zhang, checking the tip line, talking to people at the zoo, avoiding calls from the media. Most of it was unpleasant from his point of view. Brad Blankenship had been picked up by a Blue Earth County deputy and taken to the jail in Mankato, but Mattson had called to tell him about a chat with the Blue Earth County attorney. "He's going to try to push Blankenship into a corner, try to get him to deal up for Castro, but he doesn't think it's going to work. Blankenship made a call to an attorney from the jail here, and the county attorney tells me that that guy is also Castro's attorney. If what happens is what I think is going to happen, Blankenship will be out on bail by tonight on Castro's money."
"Then he's probably not going to deal up," Virgil said.
"Probably not."
"What if we said he was a danger to witnesses?"
"The bail will probably get larger, but that's all," she said. "We're still going to get the guy, but it's not exactly what we were hoping for. It'd be nice if we could deal up and get whoever paid him, but I want to see Blankenship doing time, too."
"I was hoping you'd say that, because that might be what we're going to get. If you're happy, I'm happy. And I already talked to Frankie about it, and she's okay with it. Alvarez, I think Alvarez and her husband are probably headed back to Mexico. Sparkle isn't too happy about that, but Sparkle doesn't have to go back to the pickle factory," she said.
"I don't much care what Sparkle is happy about," Virgil said. Mattson said, "Okay then. Listen, I'm up for the rest of the day. Do you need help with the Tigers?"
"I don't even have enough for myself to do," Virgil said. "If I need help, I'll call."
"Do that."
Hauser called from the Minneapolis Homicide office and said they hadn't gotten a warrant for Zhang's shoes.
"Got the wrong judge, in the wrong mood, and we were a little thin to begin with. Goddamn Zhang went out of here dragging his shoes on every carpet he saw. How about the Ferrari? It was titled to his old man. We're all over that. Crime scene's down there with vacuums looking for tiger hair."
"That was about it. No tips. No ideas from the zoo. Late in the afternoon, he went over to Peck's house and pounded on the doors, but there was no answer, and the house felt empty. Should have left a round-the-clock stakeout on Peck," he thought. "He was probably with the Tigers." With no place left to go, he looked at his watch. Sandy should be in Los Angeles, but she'd call if she actually got anything. Last gasp. He drove out to Washington County to the middle of the large circle on the older Zhang's Chinese telephone and started driving around. The countryside was lush with the end of summer coming up, the tall grasses showing gold on the edges, a few yellow leaves popping out in the aspens, birches, and soybean fields. His favorite time of year. But South Washington County was not becoming his favorite place. The roads ran all over the place, and many of the houses were set so far back from the road, or so deep behind sheltering trees, that he could see almost nothing, and he suspected that wherever the Tigers were being kept, that place would be hard to see. With nothing else to do, he kept driving, up one road and down the next, gravel to blacktop and back to gravel, red-winged blackbirds perched on cattails, rabbits warming their feet on the gravel shoulders, what might have been a mink making a dash for a culvert, and the sun slowly sank down to the horizon. The fair-weather clouds were showing orange crinkles from the setting sun when Sandy called.
"This place is a nightmare," she said. "It took an hour and 5 minutes to drive from LAX to Pasadena, 30 miles.
"I don't have a real tight grip on where Pasadena is," Virgil said.
"You have a reason for going there?"
"Yes. The FedEx packages have been dropped at a place here, and the phone is in this building. I'm going to start calling it, and we'll have a bunch of people listening for it. There are about 1 million packages, and I'm hoping he hasn't turned the ringer off. Anyway, I just got here. I'm dealing with the manager. I'll call back when we get something. If we get something."
Virgil called Mattson. "You still free?"
"Sure. For a while, anyway. I'm starting to get a little off-center. I've been up since 5 o'clock.
He told her where he was, and she said she'd drive out.
15 minutes later, Sandy called back.
"We got it. The ringer was turned off, but he had the vibration thing turned on, and we can feel the box vibrating when I call it. It's addressed to a jack-in-the-box. I don't know what that's all about, but the manager says as long as I give him a written statement that the owner is dead and this is for a police investigation, we can open it here."
"Then do it, now," Virgil said.
"I'm doing it," she said. "The box is right here and I'm typing out this statement. I hope it doesn't get us in trouble."
"Hamlet's dead, Sandy. Who's going to complain?"
"Hang on."
As he hung on, he dug in his briefcase and found Hamlet Simonian's password book. Sandy came back and said,
"Got it.
It wants a password, 4 numbers.
"You got a 4-number password?"
He looked.
"I do.
I've got 3 of them, unidentified.
Give them to me."
They hit it on the second one, and Sandy said,
"It's opening up. That's it, Virgil.
Okay, I'm paging through here. Location services are on. Oh, my God."
"Oh, my God, what?"
"He was at the zoo 3 times, Sandy said. "He was at the zoo the night the tigers were stolen. It's all right here. It actually says the Minnesota Zoo and has the time."
"Oh, kiss yourself for me. On the lips."
"What else? I mean, where else?"
"A few places in St. Paul."
She read off the addresses and Virgil said,
"That's Peck's place. That's his apartment. That's the place over in Frogtown where they sent the dryers."
"Don't know what the other ones are."
"What about Washington County?"
"Doesn't say Washington County, but there's a place out east of St. Paul. Must be it. He's been 7 times.
"That's it. Where is it?"
She read off the address. Virgil wrote it down and said, "We need to keep that phone secure. We need a list of witnesses who saw you open the FedEx box, and who saw you put the password numbers in, and who saw you open up the phone. We need names and addresses for all of them. Be sure to save the box and any documentation that comes with it, and make friends with the witnesses."
"I can do that. The manager here asked me what I was doing later tonight."
"Jesus, Sandy."
"Messing with you, Virgil."
"I will do that. I'll document everything. I haven't touched the phone except to put in the password numbers, and I did that with a stylus, so I wouldn't put my own fingerprints on it. Simonians should be all over it. Maybe Pax, if he's the one who shipped it."
"You are so good," Virgil said.
"Are you going to his place in Washington County?"
"Soon as the backup gets here," Virgil said.
"Jenkins and Shrake?" Sandy asked.
"Katrin Mattson."
"She's as good as Jenkins and Shrake. She's sort of my new heroine."
"Virgil? Be careful, huh? Both of you, please?"
"Got it covered," Virgil said as he hung up.
33.
Virgil cruised the address Sandy had given him, and it looked perfect as a tiger hideaway. The place was surrounded by tall trees, but he could see a light in a main house and a barn or an oversized garage in back.